The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're back home now. It's nice to have you back in the studio. I know this is not the only studio gig you do, though. I mean, CNBC was asking you about the popularity of Benjamins yesterday. And what was your answer?
Well, yeah, Benjamins are never out of favor. But here's the rub. Over the next 60 days, it's what one of the two Benjamins, specifically Benjamin Netanyahu or Ben Bernanke, put in motion, which may have radical impact to the oil markets and even food prices. So we've got implications in the oil market and Middle East tensions, and that's worth looking at. So what Benjamin Netanyahu does relative to Iran, that's a topic.
Well, and you know, a year ago we were talking about Iran, and it seemed like the ball was in Iran's court as far as what action was going to be taken. At this point, it seems like the decision has shifted over to Netanyahu and Israel. Are they going to preemptively strike?
Well, and you know, also a year ago you could have looked at the blowback effect from both Syria and Lebanon,
right,
and said, okay, you've got to include in an Israeli calculus what the next step of defense would be. And what has changed in the last year is that Syria has its own issues to deal with. Lebanon remains an issue,
right,
but even more important, front and center, the real calculus for Israel is the blowback from a U.S.-armed and trained Egyptian army. Do they fall in lockstep with the Muslim Brotherhood, or is there some sort of divide and conflict between the Muslim Brotherhood and the old Egyptian generals?
Well, and I think it's important to note that the old Egyptian army, actually the Mubarak army, was a carryover from Anwar Sadat and the Camp David Accords, and so Egypt became out of the picture, or it was taken out of the picture back in the late 70s. It seems to be right back in the picture now, because now that there's Muslim Brotherhood leadership, it seems at this point Egypt could be a very critical piece in the puzzle.
And as far as Israel was concerned, the Sinai was sort of a soft cushion area. There was not much to be concerned. Of course, the last week or two, we've actually had some conflict right there at the Sinai crossing.
Right.
And I think what we should remember is that the other Ben is important. Again, we're really talking about a 60-day period where what could move equity prices and oil prices and commodity prices dramatically
is either geopolitics or finance.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the Federal Reserve, the Jackson Hole meeting.
Jackson Hole, the next meeting comes at a very interesting time. And by time, we're talking specifically about the seasonality in the equity markets. Seasonality isn't just about the weather in this case. Equities are quite different. You have the proverbial rain, if you will, that does tend to consistently drop in the early fall.
Right, right. But, you know, if you think about the markets, nobody likes to get wet in the markets. We'd like to have the rain fall on the crops, thank you very much.
Yep.
But I think we may even be a little late for that.
Yeah, exactly. September and October have consistently, over the last 100 years, been sort of the weak spot in the calendar for equity investors.
Very bleak months.
Exactly. Yep. The bleakest months for equity investors. A very high percentage of annual losses coming in those 2 months. Ben can intervene, even preemptively stimulate. You know, preemptive possible with Netanyahu, preemptive stimulation on the other hand, but actually at a very high price if Bernanke is active. The current backdrop of global drought,
right,
is very significant. It's very significant because the lack of literal rain juxtaposed with the potential deluge from the Fed.
That sounds like inflation to me, David. And you know, we were just talking about the Middle East. David, the Arab Spring thing came actually in a great way from food inflation. That's what pushed things over the edge.
Well, and we saw the same thing back in 2007 and 8.
Yeah.
Drought and food prices. I mean, the drought now has taken corn prices up 42% since their lows in early June.
Right.
Wheat up 46% from their lows in the early part of May.
So the gluten-free people don't get off on this one. The wheat goes up 46%, but the corn up 42%. Yeah. I mean, there's no relief.
Rice, 15.5%. It's probably the least hit, but those are from levels seen in February and again in June.
Right.
Soybeans have been the killer. Soybeans are up 52% from the December 2011 lows, you know, following a dip in the May to June period in terms of pricing.
Well, and this is bringing up a point right now. It's causing a lot of controversy that's been there before, but now it's really critical, and that's ethanol. Okay, we're taking corn and we're turning it into gasoline at a time when there's not enough corn to eat.
Yeah, it's a doubly negative issue. On the one hand, you have ethanol pressuring a major food staple higher in price.
Right.
On the other hand, secondly, you have ethanol, which increases the average gallon of gasoline, driving up not only the budget line item, specifically gasoline intake, but subsequently increasing the cost of everything else we consume.
Okay, but I have a question for you. It's an election year. Right now, this is very controversial. We're getting into higher food prices. It's going to be corn and wheat this year. It's going to be meat and things like that next year. But are they going to suspend the requirement, the ethanol requirement, temporarily, possibly, to calm this down a little bit?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It's Congress and the Oval Office that are likely to turn away from the issue. Iowa corn farmers are enjoying the steady demand coming from that blending mandate.
Sure, it's automatic demand.
Yeah, and I think frankly, Congress and your GOP and your Democrats are looking at it and saying, yeah, it's a hot button issue. If you want to really inflame Iowa and make it a deciding point in terms of the election,
right,
yeah, just go ahead and take away that blending requirement. But what you have at stake is foreign policy initiatives and geopolitical stability. Does that sound strange that satisfying an Iowa farmer could destabilize
the
other
world,
parts of the world?
That's pretty tough.
So that leaves us asking the question, are we willing to add fuel to the flames of social unrest, again, like we witnessed in 2007 and 8, or even like last year with the Arab Spring?
Well, and you know, we're talking about ethanol and how that would apply to the prices, but the other thing that would affect inflation dramatically right now would be a QE announcement, a quantitative easing announcement. And everyone has been looking for months towards this Jackson Hole meeting and the announcement that comes afterwards. Are we sensing that there are some pre-announcements coming out?
Well, arguably the Fed has dug in its heels and made the point that fiscal action needs to be taken now. Fiscal, not monetary.
Right.
So implicitly they're conceding that the past rounds of monetary intervention from the Fed have not had the desired effects of either economic growth on the one hand or improvements in the employment figures.
Well, and just to point out, fiscal change is what comes from Washington. The Federal Reserve at this point is saying, no, we would like to see you actually start paying your bills before we print any more money.
Yeah, if you count the jobs numbers, you know, this is where they are, and I specifically mean the Fed, are a little bit unhappy. The birth-death model adjustments, added 50,000 jobs to the number. You had seasonal adjustments of over 370,000 in the most recent numbers, which implies to us that we're not moving in the right direction. And the Fed may want to act because of the jobs numbers,
sure,
but food inflation and relatively high equity values at present argue against it. So they have a conundrum coming into Jackson Hole.
Well, and the stock market feels like it is wanting to see quantitative easing. We're already seeing this stimulus thought process. We know the stock market doesn't rise without it right now.
Well, listen, if they don't get it, if the stock market does not see major stimulus from the Fed, you know, which, and it's really pricing in $600 billion or more.
Right.
If it doesn't get at least $600 billion from the next Fed meeting or post-Jackson Hole, I think you're looking at those seasonal factors, your classic September-October decline, being exacerbated by sentiment which says we're not being supported by the Fed when we need it.
Could you imagine if, going back to 1987, you remember the stock market crash in 87, it was in October, what if 1987 had been an election year? Would the president have allowed something like this? So, you know, we're looking at both sides of the issue, but if we had a 1987 event, which we are set up for, if we don't see quantitative easing announced, then, you know, how much power does Obama have actually over the Federal Reserve and one of the Bens?
Well, and that's where I wonder if Ben Bernanke isn't looking at his role as sort of a different kind of kingmaker this year.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily an Obama kingmaker, but what's good for equities, again, very short term, maybe even, you know, an improvement in price for weeks, not even months this time around. What's good for equities may be bad for global stability, you know,
sure,
bringing about the riots and political turmoil to rival last year's Arab Spring. Does Ben Bernanke want to be that kind of kingmaker this year?
Well, David, when you're talking about kingmakers, the thing that makes me feel vulnerable at this point is we've all specialized in our own little area, and we let the government do what they do. We let the Federal Reserve do what they do, the military. And when things start going awry, we really don't have the ability to take care of ourselves. Right now, we're waiting for the government to tell us whether they're going to fiscally improve. We're waiting for Ben Bernanke to tell us whether he's going to print more money. We're waiting, actually, overseas to see if Israel's going to strike first. We really do have a lot of vulnerabilities politically, and these decisions right now are affected over the next couple of months, also with the complication of an election.
You know, when you look at politics and policymaking, it depends on whether or not you're in good times or bad times in terms of the complexion that it takes on. During good times, you've got politics which may seem to be about grand strategies and policies which have sort of complex philosophical presuppositions. And indeed, you have politics of this nature, this complexion, that remains in the ivory tower at all times.
The academia, basically.
But Kevin, as you mentioned, this issue of specialization, we live in an era of specialization and sort of maximum productivity. And what's interesting is that's created a greater dependency on others for some very basic things like food. And under unfortunate circumstances, bad times, again, government policies change and focus on more basic things. You know, that could be food, water, shelter. But we're actually seeing that in China today. This week, they're set to release corn and rice from the state reserves to both hold inflation back and decrease the expense of imports of those commodities. They cannot allow for political or social destabilization.
Isn't that interesting? It shows just how nervous they are about what we were talking about a few minutes ago, and that is if the prices on grains go up, what happens is governments fall.
Yeah, and of course, this is to be expected. The politicians get involved. They try to maintain social and political stability. Under normal circumstances, politicians, you know, again, under normal circumstances, good times, you can be more intriguing in terms of your grand strategies, in terms of your pet projects.
Pet projects, a little bit like solar energy companies, things like that.
But you change to a period of real political pressure, and it's about calming the crowd, or frankly, even controlling the crowd.
Right.
That becomes the singular concern. Politics becomes just about those basics, food, water, shelter. I think, frankly, we live every day much closer to this tense environment of political self-preservation and social control. A civil society, and I mean by civil, I mean a nicely acting, a very civilized society, it's actually a very thin veneer. Underneath it is sort of gross animality, and today that is the universal constant just beneath the surface. Really what we're dealing with is having spurned morality in the good times over the last 20, 30 years as both education and policies have spurned morality in the good times, we now have in the bad times something that can turn around and bite us.
So, you know, what you're saying is the government at this point and the way the system is designed really has forced us into specialization. At its most basic, government is to safeguard borders from enemy armies and maintain domestic peace through upholding the rule of law, but they seem to be doing everything but that.
Well, and again, through specialization, there's a lot of things that we don't do anymore. We're not in charge of the vegetables in the garden. We're not in charge of the beef that we eat. We don't slaughter. We don't raise it. We're responsible for one thing and one thing only. If you're a salesman, you're a salesman. If you're a teacher, you're a teacher. If you're a trucker, you're a trucker. Whatever you are, that's what you are, and that's what you do. And it creates a tremendous amount of wealth, but it also creates a vulnerability, because when the system that allows for specialization is compromised in any way, and ironically can be something as much as weather, yes, there is the need for, actually I wouldn't say the need, but government takes it upon themselves to make sure that social stability is maintained and they fill the gap, making sure that people have what they need so that they don't lose control.
Well, and one of the things that your family has encouraged for 40 years is some sort of sustainability of your own family if the system breaks down. I mean, we're not talking about redneck survivalism necessarily, going off and hiding in the woods and thinking that you can completely survive without anyone else. That's not a reachable goal or even a probably a sane goal. We're not supposed to be islands completely. But as far as just having a little bit of food put aside, maybe some gold put aside, so if the dollar were to fail, and having the ability to do a few things that maybe are not part of our specialization, that seems to be a good long-term goal for every family listening to the program.
Well, there's no doubt. We're living today with government that's involved in every facet of our daily lives. And oddly enough, it's not that we've allowed them, sort of reluctantly allowed them to do this, but we've actually invited, we eagerly invited them into our lives as we go about our specialized lives, pursuing, frankly, our specialized versions of the good life,
right,
and leaving sort of the rest of culture and politics to equally specialized political elites.
Well, and you know, the thing is, we're talking about government here, but maybe we're thinking too small. Okay, we're looking at the United States, but the United States itself right now is no longer self-sufficient. We have a global economy, and we've interviewed Harold James a number of times talking about the destruction of that globalism, the good form of globalism, where you can actually freely trade amongst each other. The destruction of that comes when you have a meltdown or a depression start to hit. And so the sufficiency that we're talking about actually is extra national.
In that context, we have shipping rates, which have remained depressed. You've got Britain's oldest ship owner, which is the Stevenson Clark Company. They liquidated last week in bankruptcy. This is a firm that's dominated shipping going back to the 1730s.
Wow.
Obviously, there's been new players that have come on board since the 1730s and given them stiff competition.
So, David, we have a shipping company that's been around since the 1730s, from when the British Empire was truly at its greatest. It's now bankrupt. What happened? Was it betting on growth and they got shrinkage?
You know, they overinvested 4 years ago, as did every shipping company, which led to a massive oversupply of ships. They were all betting the farm on Chinese growth.
Which brings us back to why you just got back from China, because what is it? Is it growth or is it shrink? And what happens in the meantime?
Well, and then this is where you're seeing as sort of a litmus test for a return to a growth thematic or continued constraints on growth. This is interesting. In the tradable goods sector, you don't have enough product being moved at a price that justifies the amount of boats that are out there. And, you know, again, they were assuming exponential growth moving forward, and we've actually had a global contraction. So they anticipated exponential growth and got the opposite. You've got the same depressed kinds of rates, which are killing the Hamburg shipping community. Mm. You've got Greek, British, German, and Scandinavian firms, which have been the hardest hit. And of course, they dominate the shipping sector. And as more liquidations occur, the number of vessels that are available at day rates that don't come even close to covering costs further pressure the entire industry. This is sort of a classic case of pro-cyclicality. We talked about that a few weeks ago, where these companies were perfectly geared for exponential growth, having massively borrowed to grow their fleets to stay ahead of the Chinese growth curve, and has failed to recover, at least never to fully recover, with the Eurozone issues lingering, with the U.S. consumer still largely absent.
Well, and David, it's amazing. You buy too many ships. You take huge debts out to buy these ships. You stop being able to pay for the ships. You go bankrupt. Then the people you borrowed the money from go bankrupt or have to get bailed out. I mean, you have to have a retail buyer at the end to pay for all of this.
A couple things to note there. One, you've got consumer credit, which shrank from last year to this by about 31%.
Hmm.
So a 9 billion plus number is now a 6 billion number. And so, yeah, that's consumer credit as in credit card usage and whatnot. The current retail sales figures, though, actually were a decent number.
Hmm.
What, in our minds, was questionable, you know, again, we've seen the primary improvement in the numbers. Where did it come from? It came from revising lower the last reported number. So you lower the last reported number, come out at whatever number it is, and it looks to be an improvement.
It makes for growth that maybe wasn't there.
It maybe wasn't there. And the other thing we need to look at more carefully is that retail sales figures also factor in retail gasoline, the price that you're paying at the pump. That's a major component. And again, we've seen a 17% increase, as much if you're counting West Texas, as much as a 27, 28% increase if you're talking about Brent crude in terms of an increase from its lows earlier in the year. So, yes, you're going to see some positive input in the retail sales figure, but again, it's not consumers going out in sort of back-to-school buying. This is a retail component, again, that's plugged or improved or inflated, if you will, by the increase in the price of gasoline at the pump.
David, knowing now, looking back, what went into the consumption of the 2000 to 2008 period, it was mainly real estate, and people are still waiting for their real estate to come back up. Now, that's not happening here in the United States, but I know, you know, in Germany right now, people are starting to move in German real estate. Are we seeing a wave, a real estate wave, moving over into the European area?
Yeah, I think what's interesting, before talking about German real estate, is there is stabilization here in the U.S. market, largely because you've had hedge funds come in and start buying blocks of houses 1,000 at a time, diminishing the overhang of unsold or foreclosed homes. So the available stock of homes, which was 9 and 10 months worth of inventory, is now closer to 5 and 6 months worth of inventory.
And you're saying that's hedge fund buying. This is just speculation.
Private equity and hedge fund buying. And what they're doing is they're, like they used to buy apartment complexes and set them up as REITs, they're trying to set up a REIT structure for single family homes.
Hmm.
Not quite as efficient as, you know, a multifamily complex where you've got 300 doors under one roof. Now you've got a lot more lawns to clip and maintenance issues, but which is going to impact their profitability. Nevertheless, it is putting a temporary floor under the U.S. housing market, and you're seeing recovery in 5-10 of the major sectors across the country geographically.
Well, so, when you say recovery, we're not talking about necessarily making money. We're just talking about not falling anymore.
I think it's more stabilization than recovery.
Okay.
Stabilization would be the better term, but I would suggest that you've got 6 to 12 months of stabilization before a return to decline. And here's the issue. interest rates and the cost of capital will always impact real estate. So at whatever level you're at today, and that level has been determined largely by supply and demand, and in this case, oversupply and lack of demand because people can't qualify for home buying as they could in the prior to 2006 period. That's been the primary issue, supply and demand. The next shoe to drop, as we've said before many times, is interest rates, and as interest rates rise, even a marginal increase, let's put it in these terms, Kevin, a $1,000 mortgage payment is going to buy you about $200,000 worth of debt. Okay. So, and frankly, if we just go back to where we were in the 2007 period with mortgage rates at 6 to 6.5%, now you're talking about $1,000 only buying you $156,000 worth of house in terms of a mortgage payment. So we have a real estate market that is dependent on the cost of capital. And right now we've got a free pass. It would appear that we've got stabilization in the real estate market, but be cautious, be very cautious. You have another shoe still to drop, and that is interest rate fluctuation on the upside.
Well, yeah, and interest rates, David, can't go much lower. I mean, the government's giving it to the banks at almost zero right now. But okay, we've talked about hedge funds buying U.S. real estate. What about Germany? There is money going into German real estate right now.
And well, and it's money flowing into German real estate and German bonds. And what's interesting is it's telling us two things.
Okay.
One, that there's a growing number of investors who are looking at a potential D-mark return, the Deutschmark returning. And it's not just German liquidity that is prized, although that's certainly a part of the equation. If you're looking at liquidity pools, the U.S. Treasury market and the German Bund market, these are the two most liquid pools of capital in the world.
Well, David, I want to understand what you're saying. You said the return of the D-mark. The return of the D-mark? This is a signal right now that possibly we're going to see a return of a currency that hasn't been around for 10 years?
I believe a part of the speculation on German real estate is in anticipation of some sort of restructuring in the Eurozone.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know that that speculation is going to be proven correct,
right,
but there is at least the possibility.
Somebody's betting that way.
Someone is betting that way.
Yeah.
So all we're looking at is the capital flows into German real estate and saying, what is happening here? And what's the justification for it? Maybe they know something that we don't. Maybe they're just guessing that they know something we don't, and we don't know that they know anything at all. But that, you know, there's a second element. We talked about the growing number of investors looking for a return to the D-mark. There's also the fact that real estate as a hard asset is both prized, and in Germany, it's undervalued.
Well, you were in Berlin this year, okay? I mean, were you looking at some of that aspect when you were looking around?
Always keep my eyes open, always ask lots of questions. And of note was the attractive values in Berlin versus cities like London and Paris and a number of other European cities. Flat sell in Berlin at a fraction, let's say 30 to 50% less than those other European cities. So is it a double play?
A currency and a real estate play, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Strong currency reemergence, real estate. State is a diversification, buying a discounted real estate pool in the context of overvalued real estate in other parts of Europe. Yeah, we're seeing cash flowing into Germany with several motives.
Well, you know, this week's Economist magazine talks about something that we really have thought might happen, but now we're starting to see Merkel coming out and talking about how there may be a possibility of a breakup of the euro or some sort of restructuring that she would consider because Germany no longer can handle on their shoulders alone all this debt.
Yeah, Merkel, I don't think, would announce or pre-announce an exit,
right,
mainly because this would destroy cross-border capital flows and it would wreck the European banking system. I would still guess, I would still place the bet that this is brinksmanship. It's a style of negotiation that's going on that will literally...
It's going to force fiscal change, right?
Absolutely.
Austerity.
Absolutely. Germany is willing to foot the bill, but with conditions. And if those conditions are not met, she's willing to toy with those countries even to the brink of bankruptcy. She will bring them to their knees and force them to sign in blood what their fiscal responsibilities will be before she requires the German taxpayer to be on the hook for what is largesse in other parts of Europe.
Well, David, it sounds to me like this is flipping a coin. Anything's possible, but this time there is a likely outcome if you are leaning one direction or another. What's likely?
I have no doubt that Spain and Greece will leave and devalue.
Okay.
Italy is the one that the Eurozone needs to preserve, and I think that's where they're sort of ring-fencing the risk. They realize there's too much debt involved. Even though Spain has a tremendous amount of debt, Greece is frankly irrelevant in terms of the total stock of debt. They didn't want to see the first olive come out of the jar,
right.
But it is doing that anyways. I think, frankly, you can write off Spain, you can write off Greece.
You talked about Monti actually having some Austrian leanings, and when I mean Austrian, again, for the listener who's not familiar, I'm talking about free market.
Monti has more moxie than many give him credit for, and yeah. I think, again, that's where you could see some reforms put in place, and in partnership with the Germans, I think you could ultimately pull off a restructuring in Italy, particularly if the Eurozone and the ECB didn't feel that they were responsible any longer for Spain and Greece.
David, I was talking to a client that I've had for years yesterday, and he brought up a really excellent point, because we all remember the inflation of Jimmy Carter. We remember the chaos. You had Afghanistan. You had, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan. You had high inflation. You had the Iranian hostage crisis, which there's a lot of irony in that when you look at the leader of Iran right now. But we seem to be in a similar predicament to a degree. And back in 1980, of course, we saw Reagan come in. But it wasn't really Reagan that changed things initially. It was Paul Volcker changing at the Federal Reserve. He came in and he gripped the market by the throat. He raised interest rates. And it was very unpopular for a couple of years. But ultimately, he did stop the inflationary bleeding. Is that something, if we had a change in administration with Ryan, you know, now coming in as a possible VP, is this something that could happen again? Could we see them raise interest rates, get control of this, and stop the bleeding?
Well, on the one hand, you can ask the question, and there is a reasonable argument that you can do that and they should do that.
Right.
The issue is, are they able to do it and what are the constraints? Because what makes sense from the standpoint of pure economic policy may not be workable. It may not be implementable. And the limits really are balance sheet related.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is today we have $16 trillion worth of debt.
Well, back then it was $1 trillion.
Exactly. We're just pressing the $1 trillion envelope, and that seemed like an extreme number at the time. Set against our revenues, we can't cover the nut. On $16 trillion worth of debt if interest rates are to increase. One of the reasons I have concerns about the structure of our debt is not because it's not considered to be the highest quality in the world, but it's because we've had to shrink our maturities and cluster our debt in a 2, 3, 4, 5 year maturity where we have a lot of debt that's coming due in a very short period of time.
There's a great point to that. I mean, we look at these debts and we think, well, it's like a 100-year mortgage, but it's like someone just recently said, it's not a 100-year mortgage, it's a 5-year balloon payment.
Exactly. And this is where I think we have limits on our balance sheet. To raise interest rates at this juncture would absolutely destroy the U.S. economy. We would have to have tax revenues not at a 2.5 to 3 trillion mark, but closer to a 5 to 7 trillion mark. Kevin, do you know how bad that hurts? Now you're going back to the pre-Reagan era, 80% plus numbers. You're going back to the pre-Thatcher era of, again, 80% plus in terms of the highest tax bracket. Can you believe that just within our lifetime, we had those kinds of numbers? And lo and behold, it took political leadership of the kind that we saw in Thatcher and Reagan to say, wait a minute, something's not working here. Ultimately, Reagan took tax rates from 80% down to 26%. Radical, radical. But what do we have in the wake of those kinds of tax changes? One of the greatest bull markets and one of the greatest periods of growth in terms of globalization and increased global wealth we've ever seen in world history. Now, we have the French reverting to that already, 75% as the highest tax rate, Hollande. And I just want to see how French our president is and see if we can match and raise them one. It seems François Hollande would like to go back to that old era, raising the top marginal rate in France to 75%. And he, too, is using the patriotic language of it's your privilege to pay. And obviously, that's just an old tactic. But what I think is abhorrent in the U.S., I can't speak to the French, I can't speak to the British, but I can speak to a U.S. situation which I consider to be absolutely abhorrent, is people who get to vote and don't have any skin in the game. A flat tax would solve that. I'm not asking for tax breaks for the wealthy,
right,
but I don't want a complete tax break for anyone who gets to vote, because they get to vote their self-interest, which is everything and then some, which frankly is what everyone else gets to as well, but they have nothing to lose, everything to gain. And I think someone who is a taxpayer has everything to lose and something to gain. That's why I think you need more of a balance in the tax picture, and something I'd like to see in the next presidency is something closer to a flat tax.
David, it is nice to have you back in the studio. And, you know, just in closing, you had shared that it was nice to be back sleeping on your own pillow. Your family was happy to be back from traveling in Asia. But you had some insights, some thoughts, and I think you had mentioned we interviewed Jim Rogers about, a year ago. And he wrote the book Investment Biker. And it's all about a guy who takes his motorcycle all the way around the world because he didn't want to just learn what to invest in from a book or from a paper. He wanted to actually go and get his feet on the ground, get a little bit dirty, and realize that whatever he's investing in, he has, like you had said, some skin in the game.
There is an incalculable value to being in a place and seeing things and learning about small biases that you wouldn't otherwise understand from just reading in print, whether it's a newsletter or a newspaper or an article online. I think it's imperative for the investor of today to, yes, read well, but also travel well. And if you haven't read Jim's book, The Investment Biker, I think it's a great model for economics done right, certainly from an informed perspective, but with boots on the ground.
But it's experiential rather than just intellectual.
Having said that, I am glad to be home.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.